Good evening. It is just past 6 p.m. on Saturday, November the 9th. That's 11-9. That's 9-1-1 in reverse, isn't it? It is just after 6 p.m. in Seattle, Washington, in Little Saigon, on November the 9th, 2019. A lot of ones and nines in that fucking date. If you're wondering what that terrible noise was you just heard, that was the audio of some dudes taking their late model Japanese vehicle, which arguably probably had, I don't know, hundreds of thousands of miles on it, right? Because why the fuck would you do this shit? I mean, why the fuck would you hook up a nitrous injector to a probably burnt out old Japanese vehicle? But to be blunt, it's the kind of shit I would do in high school. When I was in high school, me and my friends would do all kinds of crazy-ass shit, and you know what? If we'd had the money and the resources and the time and a place to do it, we probably would have hooked up a nitrous injector to an old vehicle, too, just to see what the fuck would happen. I include that audio because one of the questions you might be asking yourself, Dan, in these strange days, given that you're a prognosticator extraordinaire, you're so connected with the ancient vibrations of the interrealm, can you tell me what the economic future looks like so I can invest in shit? Well, maybe, maybe not. But here's what I will tell you. As a hobo philosopher, as a half-ass Austrian, as a burnt-out middle-aged computer programmer, here's my fucking stupid-ass, nearly brain-addled through the abuse of beer and weed perspective. Though arguably it's the weed that's saving me right now. I'm kidding, folks. On a side note, I'm going to work on my diet starting this week. I know that there's at least 5 people, maybe as high as 8, on planet Earth, who would probably just assume I didn't give myself a Chevron diet-induced stroke. But I can't lie to you. The Chevron diet plan really fits where I'm at these days. But let's stay on topic. If you read about the concept of a crack-up boom, and what a crack-up boom is a concept in Austrian economics. And I think it wasn't Rothbard. I want to say it was either Mises or Hayek, and it very well could have been Hayek. That fuck. But whoever really coined it, the concept of a crack-up boom relates to money printing. Now, here's the thing about money printing, and as Donald Trump keeps poking Jerome Powell, we're going to learn a lesson here pretty soon. The thing about printing money is that in reality, despite all the bullshit that comes out of Paul Krugman's mouth, money printing does nothing to the economy at all. In terms of causality, if you create debt or cash or some fucking stimulus program, at the very moment you created it, at the very moment you allocated the capital, nothing actually happened yet. There's no new oil. There's no new copper. There's no new silver or anything. There's just the notional idea that you magicked into existence capital that's really just worthless debt. Now, in the 1930s, the U.S. economy probably had a lot of slack. It's one of the Keynesian lessons they learned. And yeah, here's the thing about printing money. In theory, if you have a lot of slack, meaning a lot of excess resources, excess labor, excess, you know, inputs to production, most importantly, excess energy. Because the name of the game, and I don't care what techno-babble bullshit you get suckered by, the name of the game when it comes to civilization, and certainly the kind of civilization we've become accustomed to, name of the game is energy, folks. So at the very moment you print money, there is no new energy. No one built a new nuclear power plant. No one discovered a new fucking vein of coal. No one fracked any oil. No one invented cold fusion or hot fusion just because you magicked into existence debt. So in the 1930s, there was a lot of excess oil. And keep in mind, folks, back in the day, 100 years ago, for one barrel of oil, you got roughly 100 barrels, which is pretty fucking good when you think about it. At this point in human history, for every barrel of oil we use to extract oil, we get about 2 or 3, depending upon where you are in the world. Some situations are so terrible that if you do the proper accounting, like shale or tar sands, if you actually did the proper accounting, if these companies actually paid for everything required to make this shit work, in reality, we probably, you know, it's like one barrel for a barrel. It's how ridiculous it is right now. Maybe 2 barrels to 1. But if you think of it in terms of energy, wasted methane, wasted energy creating the oil, like they do in fucking Alberta, boiling tar sands. It really does get worse, folks. So anyways, the thing about the crack-up boom is at first it seems awesome. That's the thing about the crack-up boom. And I don't care if it's Donald Trump or Tulsi Gabbard in 2021. It's fucking irrelevant. It does not matter when this happens. I kind of thought they were going to make Trump their crack-up boom clown. But maybe not. Maybe he isn't going to be the crack-up boom clown. Kind of think he's perfect for that fucking role, though. Phase one of the crack-up boom is a lot of growth, quote-unquote, a lot of prosperity, quote-unquote, lots of employment. In fact, it becomes very obvious very quickly that labor resources run out fast in a crack-up boom. That's phase one. Phase two of the crack-up boom is when people start to notice, and it's slow at first, that their paycheck just doesn't go quite as far as it used to, despite all the fucking programming they get from the media telling them it's never been cheaper to live. During that second phase of the crack-up boom, people that enjoy wine, well, they'll buy one bottle, and then maybe they'll buy two others because, hell, the prices are going up so fucking fast. Why don't I stock up on wine today? Now you're wondering, what part of the boom is a crack-up boom? Remember the redneck kids with the Toyota Corolla or some other fucking Korean or Japanese car? You remember them hooking up the nitrous injector to the engine and letting that fucking nitrous flow so fucking fast and hard? Yeah, that's the last phase. And if you want to ask, is it inflation or deflation, you're not really looking at it the right way. During a crack-up boom, it is inflation. By definition, it is the expansion of the monetary base. And yeah, it's true, it's true. Alan Greenspan, that lovely old fuck, he redefined inflation back in the 90s, just like he redefined fucking unemployment and the GDP. So it's true that a lot of inflation gets covered up. For example, housing costs are not properly accounted for in inflation numbers. Neither is healthcare, or the cost of higher education, or pretty much anything you need. And that includes food. And when we talk about food, let's keep things in perspective, folks, because a year from now, some of you are going to be in a really sad place. Some of you are going to wonder, why didn't somebody tell me about this? I would not have lost the 50 pounds. If someone had told me what was coming, I would have just been okay with the extra 50 pounds because I was going to lose that weight one way or the other, and that's what's coming. In the last phase of a crack-up boom, everything breaks down. Everything. The problem with debasing currency that a lot of people don't understand is that it impacts civic society. It impacts trust. If you print too much money, the level of trust, in theory, goes to zero. So no one's going to give you any food, any water, any shelter in the final phase, no matter how many fucking greenback electronic tokens, no matter how many fucking Bitcoin or Ethereum. If that person can't take what you give them and translate it into food, water, shelter, they're not going to take your fucking money. In the final phase of the crack-up boom, you get to learn about the concept of fragility. And let me be more fucking specific as I drink a little fucking water here. You get to learn the meaning of just-in-time. Just-in-time delivery, just-in-time binning, just-in-time logistics is just-in-time, which means you don't have a lot of extra shit on hand. There's a couple days worth of food in pretty much every city right now. So I just wanted to let you guys know, if you want to know what I think is coming economically, I don't know for certain. As I've stated in the past, we're in the great discontinuity. We're actually in the infinite free will space as we speak. Anything that could happen, can happen, has a likelihood of happening, could very well happen. But the one thing that can't happen, by definition, in a great discontinuity, is you cannot make a certain prediction. It is literally the definition of a discontinuous period of time. The best you can do is make predictions of tomorrow based on today. which means the great discontinuity follows the Markov properties of probability, which is kind of good news because it means that in terms of calculating the expanding tree, you only have to apply the product rule. I say this because the Bayesian rules of complex probability aren't nearly as easy to work with as you might think. So good news, great discontinuity, the product rule applies. And yeah, if you want to know what's going to happen tomorrow, ask yourself what happened today. Yesterday is gone, people. Yesterday is no more, just like the fucking carpenter said. Anyways, we'll see. Trump might not be the crack up boom clown. I currently think Tulsi Gabbard seems likely for 2020 only because she fits the fucking storyline. It has nothing to do with popularity. I don't care if Trump is popular or not popular. Bernie Sanders was very popular amongst Democrats in 2016. Bernie Sanders won a shitload of primaries. Bernie Sanders technically should have been the Democratic candidate, and even Bernie Sanders knew right from the beginning it was never going to happen. Never, ever, ever. Not part of the storyline. But a young, attractive, photogenic, you know, U.S. Army officer from Hawaii that knows how to surf and is a woman. Well, I mean, that's basically year of the woman shit right there. And have we had a woman president yet? No. And Elizabeth Warren, oh my God, if she's literally this year's Hillary, yeah, she literally is. She's got no chance in hell. This year's Obama's Tulsi. So I don't know who the crack up boom clown is going to be. It could be Trump again. Okay, I will give you this. It's either Tulsi or Trump. I don't believe any other Democrat has a chance against Trump in terms of the storyline. And the deep state, they fucking own Hollywood. They love good storylines. And they don't have to be that complicated. Just a little more complicated than the World Wrestling Federation storylines, or maybe General Hospital. That's it. But if you think voting has anything to do with it, next topic. If you don't know who Guy McPherson is what you'd refer to as a climate alarmist. And when I say this, I will tell you, I think he's a sincere guy. I've watched a lot of his fucking videos, his podcasts. I've never met him in person. He is someone I would love to interview if I can get my interview over the internet shit squared away. But the thing is, though, is I have no reason to believe he's not sincere. And also, I have no reason to believe he's not knowledgeable about the areas he claims to be knowledgeable about. Things like conservation, biology, the environment, stuff like that. Generally speaking, he seems to know what he's talking about when it comes to the ecosystem, okay, and the environment. Keep it that simple. When he gives his little lectures, he often quotes Daniel Quinn, that civilization is locking up food. And I personally think that idea, and before I go there, I checked out the guy's website, ishmael.org. I don't know a lot about the guy, but he seems to be promoting something that I kind of agree with. I mean, I think it's an empowering idea to let people control the food. In essence, and let me put it in my terms, for local communities to get control of where their food comes from is simply common fucking sense. Okay, that's just rational. The fact that they convinced you that you should have your food shipped to you from hundreds of miles away, yeah, They convinced you of this, but that is not rational. So I believe it's a rational position before I get into the next step, which will sound like I'm beating up on the guy. But I'm really not. I simply disagree. I don't think civilization is locking up the food in the sense that civilization is about a bunch of monks or a priestly class or higher level senators or congressmen or ancient dictators and kings controlling the granaries. Yes, that's part of it, but that's really not what's going on. In fact, that's not even the fucking problem. It really isn't, folks. It's a problem, I agree. It is a problem. It is not the problem. The problem isn't the locking up of food. The problem is the abstraction of food. And I've spoken about this in previous podcasts. It's related to this woolly-headed bullshit belief that comes in various forms. And frankly, I think Guy McPherson has his own form of it. And the general theory is this, that before civilization, human beings were basically, you know, safe little creatures that were so good at living in balance that when the Native Americans arrived 20-some thousand years ago, they basically reshaped the Midwest with their non-technological balance bullshit. That was me just taking a side road. The basic argument that pre-technological humans did not damage their ecosystems is bullshit. I'm not saying they destroyed them completely. What I'm telling you is that, like the little hard-working beaver, prehistoric humans didn't give a shit. If the result of them going around hunting buffalo radically changed the Great Plains from an ecological standpoint, it wasn't even on their fucking radar. But when civilization arrived, something important happened. And this is kind of important because this leads to people doing really sociopathic bullshit. When civilization arrived, the process of getting food became very fucking abstract. We're not talking about some dude picking up a rock and flinging it at a gazelle. Probably one of the first examples of humans killing and eating was something like that. And even that action itself compared to a tiger is kind of abstract. You know, we call ourselves Homo sapiens, but what we really are, beyond that, are tool users. We've been tool users right from the fucking beginning. And by the way, we're probably not the only creatures on planet Earth that dabble in tool use. We're just the ones that got really fucking good at it. Really good. Civilization is not locking up the food. It really isn't. I don't think that's the core issue. In fact, I think that's misleading. It leads you to believe that if all we could do was take away the wretched power of the government, then somehow we would be free. And here's how I look at it. I agree with that because I'm an anarchist. I think government is bullshit. But what I don't believe in is utopian bullshit. Okay? Utopian idealistic crap. That's crap. Human beings are more destructive today than they have ever been. But there has never been a time. Ask the fucking Neanderthal. Ask all those little hobbit people they found fucking bones of. There has never been a time when we were safe. Even to each other. Ask Peking, man. Ask the fucking bones of dead humans that lay discovered 90, 100,000 years old right next to fires. Bones cracked open so other humans could eat the marrow. Humans were never safe, folks. We were never furry little lovely creatures. I would say ask the Neanderthal, but they were both raped and killed. That's reality, folks. And that's if you're an atheist, okay? I don't want to get into the religious way of looking at this, because that's a very different way of looking at this. And I went kind of religious the other day with the whole Jonah thing. And also, before I leave this topic, I'm not beating up on Dr. McPherson. I think he's a good man. He's a good man doing what a lot of people are trying to do now, understand what's going on. Do I think he's right about us all having a couple years left to live? Well, the good news is we're going to find out pretty quick because his timeline is very fucking short. if you believe what Guy McPherson says, and this also applies to Dane Wigington, because even though he would say, stop the geoengineering, he also points out, even if you do that, most of us are still probably fucked. So the good news about Guy McPherson's predictions is we're going to know if they're bullshit pretty fast. Not as fast as that German dude who told us on November the 3rd, all people of Seattle would rue their existence. They would enter a hellish realm of flames and smoke. They'd all go broke. And they'd do some coke. Next topic, this hour of the Little Saigon Report. This hour of the Little Saigon Report is brought to you by Love Systems of Little Saigon. I know a lot of you out there probably, well, maybe, I don't know how many of you are lonely. Out there waiting to fall in love. To find that woman of your future life. Or that man or that je. At Love Systems of Little Saigon, we explain to you the complexities of love. We provide videos. Dr. Grunkus, who is a well-known primary care physician in Little Saigon, he is the main medical advisor to Love Systems of Little Saigon. At Love Systems of Little Saigon, they will explain to you where the flimtic rod goes. If you're a young man who's coming of age, or a woman who's being converted into a man by Dr. Grunkus in his very strange, very dangerous man-to-woman, woman-to-man conversion fucking warehouse. Dr. Grunkus opened a warehouse for male-to-female conversion-type scenarios. There are cameras 24/7. He doesn't really want to get shut down. At Love Systems of Little Saigon, if you are a guy or a gal who used to be a guy or a guy who used to be a gal, they'll explain to you what the flimtic rod is and where the undulator on the woman's gazumbus is. Call it the Call of Cthulhu. So if you're out there tonight and you're lonely and you don't have the ability to find love, make love, you don't have enough love, come to Love Systems of Little Saigon and all of your desires will be fulfilled. Next topic. I'm going to tell you guys something. I want you to listen. I hope you listen quite well, especially those of you who are young. or I should say younger than me, or those of you who might not be younger than me but still want to take chances, go on trips, you know, just participate in some 1980s musical video montage about changing your life around. You know you're out there, you fucks. If you are at home or on the road, if you are living in a house with a family, either your own or somebody else's, excuse me, I had to reposition some shit there. My own flimtic rod became engudgulated. If you live at home or live in an apartment, if you live someplace alone, if you get a knock on the door like knock, 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 somebody knocks on the door, I gotta just say this, folks, because this has happened to me in the past, and it's hard because if you're at all religious or spiritual, if you have a sense that there's something behind the reality that you take for granted, and if you're Irish and happen to be a drunk, in addition to all the above, and you happen to be middle-aged and wondering, how am I going to finally do something with my life that has any fucking meaning, and you get a knock on the fucking door, and at the door is an old wizard named Gandalf and some fucking troll or dwarf, and he's saying to you, listen, buddy, we got this terrible adventure. We need you to join us. Someone stole this fucking ring. It's got all kinds of power. One ring to rule them all, buddy. J.R.R. Tolkien. I'm about to say something about him that I do not know is true, but I suspect is true. I suspect it's true because a lot of his fucking fiction kind of fits this weird kind of almost fictional justification for what I call righteous militarism. And here's what righteous militarism is. It is the belief that there are countries or armies or peoples or places where things are happening that are so bad that we should form up an army, go there, and destroy the bad guys. And if you want a reference for this type of warfare, see the Crusades. From the 10th century all the way up until the 14th fucking century. If you want to understand what I mean by this concept of righteous fucking warfare. Sorry, I got more problems here than I know what to deal with as far as my shit goes. My studio, per se, is literally a studio apartment, and I don't really have a really good setup, so... But I'm doing the best I can, which is pretty bad. If Gandalf shows up at your door, I'm going to tell you something I think is true about J.R.R. Tolkien. I think he was connected with the Tavistock Institute. Now, if you don't know what the Tavistock Institute is or was, it was a propaganda institute out of the UK just prior to World War I that had a big part to play in convincing all the good little Americans that all the Germans, that the Kaiser, that the Hun, they were all evil as fuck, and there was some kind of righteous fucking war to be fought against the Hun. Now, of course, the book wasn't this book, the story of The Hobbit, it wasn't written before World War I. That's not my point. My point is, after the war, after the great war of defeating the evil Germans, I think that this fucking book and these stories kind of were designed to convince people that there is such a thing, that you can fight a good fight against an evil enemy, and no matter how many people die, no matter how many cities burn, even if there are only three people left, it's still the righteous thing to do. If Gandalf shows up at your door, knock, 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 and says, come with me on some magical fucking journey, here is my advice. Before you go with Gandalf, before you go to that recruiting office where they offer you that bonus, before you get married, before you buy that fucking house and go into massive debt, ask yourself this question. Is this a crusade that I need to go on? Okay? And let me be more specific. If you are someone who's out there and you're lonely and you're in a position of where, well, frankly, you could be taken advantage of, there are a lot of fucking Gandalfs out there that are not really Gandalf, they're just grifters. So be fucking careful is all I say. If Gandalf shows up at your fucking hobbit hole telling you about some fucking adventure against some fucking magical dragon named Smaug, maybe your best fucking move is to say, fuck you, Gandalf. Get off my fucking porch. I'm gonna call the hobbit police. Or, since I'm an anarchist, I will simply just get my Mossberg 12-gauge. Yeah, try your wizard shit on that, buddy. Buckshot federal rounds. Next topic. I just wanted to... Before I go to the next topic, though, my point in that previous one is simple. Be fucking careful. And it's not always a stranger. Sometimes people in your own life will get suckered into something, and they will try to convince you, come on the fucking journey. I am not saying turn down adventure. I'm not saying don't do it. I'm saying that in my opinion, freaking Bilbo Baggins, the first sucker, the sucker that started the whole fucking series, I think Bilbo was actually a really risky person. I think he took big risks. No good hobbit would have let that fucking wizard into their fucking hobbit hole. No good hobbit would have done that. The fact that he let that fucking wizard in, the fact that he didn't try to call the hobbit police or pull out his fucking hobbit 12-gauge, makes me think that, yeah, he wanted to go on an adventure. He was that fucking lonely. Next topic. A lot of people will talk about bucket lists. Like, I have a bucket list of things I want to do before I die. And I've never really thought about it until recently. The main reason why I've never really considered the bucket list is it makes it seem it does make it seem as if, in a really kind of fucked up, misguided way, that we have these kinds of options. Like, I can make out a list of things like, oh, before I die, I want to go downhill skiing, at Sugar Bush or one of those fucking foo-foo places. The problem is, what if there's no snow? Like, what if there's no snow to go skiing? So, yeah, I don't know if I can go downhill skiing. Or what if I say, oh, I really want to fish for tuna in the Pacific Ocean? Well, I don't really want the cesium, though. And as far as bucket lists that require money, which, fishing for tuna and fucking downhill skiing require funds, those bucket lists are the least interesting to me. But let's assume I could have a bucket list with the Grand Canyon, which I've never seen, be on my bucket list. No. I don't need to see a hole in the ground. I know you're saying, Dan, the Grand Canyon's beautiful. So no, seeing the Grand Canyon is not on my bucket list. And maybe bucket list in my case is the wrong fucking name. Maybe it should be called fuck it list. Like fuck this, fuck that, fuck the fucking situation I find myself in, and fuck you. The fuck it list. It's a list of things I just want to fuck off about. But let me just list a few things. Like, for example, I've never done cocaine. Never. And as you well know, I am fairly honest about the shit I put in my body because, hey, don't do to yourself what I've done to myself, right? Like the Chevron diet. Don't do the Chevron diet. Don't do that. If you don't know what the Chevron diet is, you only buy food from Chevron gas stations, and you only eat it if it comes out of a can. That's the Chevron diet. So yeah, I've never done cocaine. And I know it wouldn't be good for me. I know it would probably kill me. But it's sort of like if I knew I was going to die, either from cancer or most likely from some sort of congestive heart failure, if I knew I was going to be wiped out by some illness, or maybe everyone gets wiped out, maybe Guy McPherson is right. Then I kind of need a fuck it list. So item number one is cocaine. Item number two is I would really love to build a six-barreled, 12-gauge, gravity-fed Gatling gun shotgun. Okay, and the idea is you would it would be kind of like a well, you would sit down. And you would have pedals, and the pedals would drive a flywheel, and the flywheel would drive the hydraulics in the feeder. And so essentially, it would be a pedal-powered system for sending a lot of 12-gauge downrange with a big old hopper on top that you could just pour 12-gauge into, mixed ammo, as long as it's 12-gauge. It has a gravity-fed reorienting hopper. So it's kind of like a digestive system. So yeah, you just pour in the 12 gauge, you pedal away, you fire it down. I don't know where I could do this without getting arrested, but I would like to build a 12-gauge Gatling gun before I die. Item 2. First the cocaine, then the 12-gauge Gatling gun. Next topic, I would like a 1968 Pontiac GTO Cherry Red with tri-power. If you don't know what tri-power is on that 400 cubic inch engine, it's 3 2-barrel carburetors dumping a lot of fuel, a lot of love, a lot of power, really fast with that dual-gate automatic transmission. But then I would take that 1968 Pontiac GTO, that cherry red GTO, and I would mount a rail gun on it, because that GTO would be putting out so much power, I could probably bleed some off into a capacitor bank, put the capacitor bank in the trunk of the fucking GTO, and then maybe have a 50 caliber rail gun. And your question would be, Dan, why would you mount a railgun on your 1968 Pontiac GTO? And I would say to you, this is my fuck it list, not yours. Fuck you. Cocaine, number one. Number two, 12-gauge Gatling gun. Number three, 68 GTO, cherry red, with, you know, a railgun mounted on the top. You know, 20-round capacity. Next up, and maybe this is the last item I'll talk about from my fuck it list, my bucket list, you know, my list. The last item, I want to build a high altitude aerostat, and an aerostat is basically a kind of lighter than air craft. I want to build a high altitude airship capable of long-term flight at 70,000 feet plus. I want it to have panoramic windows. I want it to be capable of being up for at least a month. And then I want to circumnavigate the world, but to do so from pole to pole. Kind of like Ava Adams in a porno, right? Yeah, pull the pole. That's too dirty for the audience, Dan. You shouldn't have mentioned Ava Adams. So there you go. I've given you my bucket list, my fuck it list, my list of shit I would love to do before I die. Item number one is the cocaine. Item number two is the 12-gauge Gatling gun capable of taking mixed 12-gauge ammo, including sabot rounds, all kinds of slugs, buckshot, birdshot, fuck it. It's my 12-gauge Gatling gun. It'll take all that ammo as long as it's 12-gauge. I need my cocaine, my 12-gauge Gatling gun, my 1968 Pontiac GTO with a roof-mounted rail gun of the 50 caliber range, with an actual 50 caliber type, with an actual range of at least, you know, maybe 100 miles, because fuck you, why I want it. It's my business, not yours. And last but not least, a high-altitude dirigible, lighter-than-aircraft aerostat capable of staying aloft for at least a month or two that I can fly around the world in and see all that shit they're hiding from us in fucking Antarctica. And I can even find out if there is a fucking Antarctica. Because as I've mentioned in the past, folks, I am a cosmological agnostic. It is a function of my faith. Once I figured out there was a God in heaven, the nature of reality became not so much less interesting, just less solid. Because once you believe in a divine being with powers beyond your imagination, you realize that probably any conception of the universe is still going to be wrong. Next topic. Along the lines of our weird conversation about the nature of the human, are we a fuzzy, fuzzy creature of woolly-headed niceness? Are we the noble savage of Rousseau? Or are we really just a maniac beaver with a thirst for blood? You fucking make your own decision. And if you're a Christian, you'd say, Dan, we're human beings. We're God's chosen people. We have souls. We're not like the fucking tigers or the bears or the chimpanzees. And that's okay. But some of my listeners aren't necessarily religious. And frankly speaking, you can look at this problem from more than one perspective. You really can. God gave us reason and logic to understand the world. Humor and sociopathy. In a weird, fucked up way, I think they're connected issues, people. I think that there's something that's always been a little bit fucking sociopathic about what human beings laugh at. And it's not a new thing. It's not like, oh shit, suddenly, in the last few decades, because of technology, we're a bunch of assholes. No, I don't think that's the case. I think we've always considered things funny that are really in poor taste. And I think there's a very simple reason for this. Or maybe not too simple, but straightforward, I think. A big part of learning is surviving. Which means if you don't survive, It doesn't matter what you fucking learn. So, in order to learn, you need to survive. And I know that sounds silly and stupid and almost circular, but it's an important concept in the context of what is funny. Because I would contend one of the reasons why we laugh is because it happened to somebody else. Listen, it's rarely funny if it happens to you. I don't care what the joke is. It can be the pie in the face. It can be the de-pantsing, you know, he pulls somebody's pants down. Mooning people. Prank fucking phone calls. Or any number of jokes. Because I guarantee you, if you scratch below the surface, pretty much every fucking joke you've ever heard has a target. And from the target's perspective, it isn't a joke. It's an insult. It's sadness. Not always. Not in every case. I'm a middle-aged, you know, burned-out computer programmer straight Irishman. There are so many jokes you can make about me. My dad was a logger. He was a lumberjack. I know the Monty Python skit. I learned that one pretty quick. I mean, I am personally layer upon layer of scar tissue. So if someone were to try to make fun of me, to make me cry, it would take a lot of effort. It doesn't always take effort to piss me off, but that's mostly because of annoyance. Like, I just don't want your bullshit in my head. I already have too much shit in my head. I don't need your crap. But in terms of insults, I don't really care. Say what you want about me. If you say something about me that is negative, that I have never said about myself, I don't have any money, but if I had some money, I'd send you a fucking award. Holy shit, something new. But there are a lot of people out there that don't have a sense of humor at all about themselves, about their ideas. There are a lot of folks, especially in times like these, where people just have no sense of humor about anything, where everything is so stressful, so tense, that if you make a joke, it's like you're fucking attacking somebody physically. Like, and again, I'm not justifying this. I think censorship is bullshit. And I think if you're a person that, well, how can I phrase this? If you're a ticking time bomb, and all I have to do is use the right word and I set you off, like from some fucking character from that silly movie Telephone from the 70s, the one with Charles Bronson. If you're a ticking time bomb, and all I have to do, I'm gonna drink a little water here. All that is required of Uncle Dan is to say the right fucking word and you explode. Then, yeah, I don't know what to tell you. But what I'm telling all you folks out there that are not ticking time bombs, that have something like a sense of humor, it is important to note. Humor has probably always been a little bit sociopathic. There's something great about not being the victim, folks. Listen, back in the day, when we were hunting the buffalo, so fucking clever, every once in a while we got chased by the grizzly bear or the cave bear or the fucking saber-tooth bullshit. Man, that must have been bullshit. Every once in a while. And in those cases, if there are five of you and one saber-toothed tiger, you're probably not all going to die. Here's the thing about these predators. They're not crazy. If they take one of you down, they're going to want to eat you as quickly as possible or stash you away someplace. They're not going to, like, let their food be taken by some other motherfucking saber-toothed tiger. So if there's five of you, and one of you gets taken down, it buys the other four time. And then later on at the cave, as you console the widow, And as you draw your cave paintings, you make a joke about him and his funny feet and stuff like that. And I'm sure the ancient jokes were pretty much fairly basic bullshit. But the bottom line is this. The way that you deal with that trauma, sometimes it's through sadness. Like when my sister Nancy died, I dealt with the trauma mostly with a lot of darkness and sadness. That's how I processed it. A lot of closed up feelings, a fair amount of drinking, you know, I'm Irish, and a lot of fucking sadness in general. But some people will process tragedy with humor, and guess what? That's okay too. In fact, I do both. When these days I try to make a joke out of as many things as I possibly can. If I see a homeless guy fucking a Toyota Prius like I did last February, I make a fucking joke out of it. Okay? Because if you can't laugh, you're gonna cry. I make a joke out of the rat garden. Is there actually a little fucking, you know, patch of vines next to our apartment building where I suspect 50 to 100 rats live? Yeah. Any night as you walk down there, you'll see a rat or two in the streets, and believe me, they're getting bolder. A few weeks ago, one of them looked up at me, and I thought, holy shit, he might be hungry enough to signal his friends. Think about Wile E. Coyote. Wile E. Coyote chasing the Roadrunner. Think about good old Wile E. Coyote. You know, being blown up, being shattered, being smashed, going off all kinds of cliffs and falling to his death. He keeps coming back, and that's the nice part. But in the real world, for those of us who are not Wile E. Coyote, or Jesus Christ, or Lazarus, you know, Lazarus, for those of us who are simply human beings, when we go off a cliff, when we get hit by a giant Acme rocket filled with TNT, spelled in capital letters, we just die. So I guess what I'm saying here, and maybe I'll just sort of leave it, I'll leave the podcast with this thought, is maybe humor has always been kind of dark in the way that sadness is dark too. I mean, maybe humor has always been very close to sadness, except for in that case, you don't cry, you laugh. And I guess you mock. I mean, what is it that the conscious being does in the night? Not today, not with your fucking libraries, not with your fucking internet, not with your smartphone. But imagine you lived about, I don't know, 20 or 30,000 years ago, and you're experiencing the true darkness of the night. And there are some of your friends, and you're cold, and maybe if you're lucky, you're huddled around a fire. How do you deal with that? How do you deal with the fact that you're a conscious being? Okay, you have consciousness, you have awareness, but you don't have a lot of information. Which means that a lot of your quote-unquote information that you do gather ends up being kind of fear-based. A lot of fear. Okay, where there is no knowledge, and this is another one of my, not my, I think it's a general rule. I think a lot of people kind of come to know this. Where there is no knowledge, there is always fear. That's reality, folks. And I'm not saying you should like things that are strange or weird. That's not my fucking point. I'm saying don't be afraid of them if you have knowledge about them. So it is Saturday night. We've had a pretty good podcast for the last hour. I'll remind you that Love Systems of Little Saigon is open 24 hours a day. They take credit card. They take Bitcoin. They take everything. They will take your lonely life. They'll take your lonely life and convert it into something new. At Love Systems of Little Saigon, you and your flimtic rod have never been better.